Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dr. Scott Jensen podcast. I'm Andy Schmidt. I'm here with Dr. Scott Jensen. We are back for episode two of the podcast. The first one, people really liked it. They're positive. It was some positive feedback. So I'm excited to jump into this new podcast. Today we're going to jump into it right away. Right out of the gate, I want to talk about, I think it was last Tuesday, the shooting in Atlanta, Georgia that happened, where eight women were shot and killed in a spa. And most people have probably already heard this news, and the shooter was a 21-year-old white male. And so this is a horrific thing that happened, and it's just awful. And I think that it'd be good for you to give a response to the situation. But before you do, I want to just give some clarity. I think right out of the gate, the left tried to push that this was a white hate crime, and that the worst thing, this is white supremacy, white hate, all that. And so I want to just read what I've read the authorities say in this situation, is that the authorities said in a news conference that based on his confession, the shooter's confession, they believe the shootings were, quote, not racially motivated, and that the shooter instead allegedly opened fire because he saw the locations as an outlet for him to succumb to purported sex addiction temptations. And so that's what the authorities said. It's an ongoing investigation, obviously. And so here's the thing that I think usually happens when we see shootings that gain nationwide media attention, is that Republicans are most often looked at as kind of heartless, and that we don't care. We don't care about the people. We care about our guns and this and that. And I think that's a wrong assessment of how Republicans look at these situations. But you, as a Republican, I want to ask, what's your response to this shooting? What do you think about this situation?
Well, thanks, Andy. It's good to be back. Though it's just certainly a challenging first issue to address. When I think of what happened in this killing, I think of three responses. I think of the mainstream media response, which is typically very urgent and at times very sensational. Then I think of the political responses, and I think of those as being oftentimes spin doctoring. There's always an interest in trying to, well, let's see if I can say something really clever. Yeah. And then I think the third group of responders is American people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the common sense is going to come from. When we hear the American people respond, I don't see myself as a politician. I'm not a part of the mainstream media. As just an American citizen, what do I think? It just makes my heart sad. I see families devastated, kids and parents devastated. Who knows what those victims might have accomplished in their lives? It's all about John Donne. When a Clyde be washed away by the sea, I am the less. I think that I'm not interested in playing Monday morning quarterback and saying, well, this or that. I think I'll leave that to the professional politicians to have the knee-jerk reflexes and talk about the urgency for gun legislation. It's just gut-wrenching. Yeah. And yet I can't help but think of the shooting in Colorado as well.
Right.
And again, the same response patterns. We've got the mainstream media. We've got the politicians. And then we've got Americans. And I think it's the Americans that oftentimes, it's just the John Doe citizen that really gives us that more thoughtful, gee, I don't know what to think. I need to process it. I feel terrible for those families. My prayers go out to them. And then we find out that in the Colorado shooting, the gunman bought the gun a few days earlier and passed the background check. So right off the bat, that should tell us that you could pass 20 more laws and it wouldn't stop that. Yeah. I think we have to ask the question, does the NICS system work? Does the background check system work? You can ask that question. But I'm in no hurry to try to come up with some fancy comment. I just feel terrible for the victims, their families, their loved ones, and the lives that might have been changed for the better had these people been able to live a normal and full lifespan, because who knows what contributions they would have made.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that it's also important, like Republican or Democrat, to like keep, you know, pray for these families and pray for the people that were affected by the situation, because I've never been through anything like this, but I, you know, it's hard to imagine how hard it would be. I just pray for these people. I know I am, and I'm sure you are, Scott. Just pray for these people. But you talked about what happened in Colorado also, which is just another horrible thing. And so I guess I want to ask your take on kind of the Second Amendment, and what do you think, like, about gun restrictions? Because that is the topic that everybody's talking about now. Obviously, like, that's kind of the result of something that, when a shooting happens, people always go straight to that, gun restrictions. And so what is your thoughts on the Second Amendment and restricting guns?
I've always thought that I'm a powerful supporter of the Second Amendment rights. I always think of the Second Amendment as five syllables on each side of a comma. To keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I think within the Second Amendment, we can still take a page from President Trump's playbook and have hard discussions. I've never voted for a gun restriction bill. I've used that occasional strategy where I'll temporarily sign on to a bill to see if I can get a committee chairman to have an informational hearing, just talk about things. I think that all Minnesota voices need to be respected, and that's partly why I've been willing to do that. There are thousands of people out there, thousands and thousands, hurting, and they clamor for public safety. In that noise, in that space, we need to be able to have conversations. But in terms of the Second Amendment rights specifically, red flag legislation is one of the most horrific violations of the Constitution I could imagine. There's no due process. It's just wrong. If I were governor, I would sign a bill to strengthen our ability in terms of standing our ground. I think right now in Minnesota, you have an obligation to try to retreat. In retreating, oftentimes you put yourself at more harm's risk. So I think that I would want to strengthen that. I do not believe that universal background checks are appropriate. I think that we've got enough laws on the books in that regard. I like the idea that if I'm going to sell a gun to a private seller, I could potentially have a permissive pathway available to me whereby I would get safe harbor. But that can be discussed and crafted by NRA and Minnesota gun owners. But I strongly support Second Amendment rights.
Yeah, and I know you this last week did a video with, who was that with?
I did it with Neil Johnson from Lumberjack Logic. Okay. Straight shooting, forward-thinking, insightful interviewer. I definitely encourage people to go to Neil Johnson at Lumberjack Logic. He gets to the heart of the issue.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to that video in the description of this podcast. Go check that out, because I watched a little bit of it. It was a fun interview. So kind of then pivot to some other issues. I know you talked about this. We were talking before this and what we were going to talk about in this podcast. You talked about the southern border. What exactly do you want to talk about?
Again, when I was growing up, I remember my dad would say, Scott, don't just stand there, do something. But in politics, I think we almost have to flip that. And we have to say, don't just do something, stand there. And I think someone might say, well, why would you just stand there? When standing there and ruminating over something, that's when we get context. So let's just talk about the southern border. I think what we're seeing is the fallout from politicians not thinking through their proclamations. The idea of an open border, I think it makes no sense. A Gallup poll came out recently. It said that there are 33 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, amounting to approximately 500 million people. Now, remember, the United States is 325 million. So we have 500 million people. 25% of those people want to move to another country to find a new life. Of those, that would be 120 million. Of those, 42 million want to move to the United States. I'm not saying anything about what our present immigration policy is or isn't, what it should look like or shouldn't. But I think we need to think through when we have within literally hundreds and hundreds of miles, 42 million people that want to move to our country. We can't afford to do something foolishly. I would ask the question, what are we doing for our own veterans that come back with PTSD, Agent Orange exposure, Parkinson's disease? What are we doing for them? What are we doing for those veterans who are homeless? What are we doing for the homeless that aren't veterans? We have to take care of our own, because if we don't, we allow a whole nother set of problems to be created. And I think we're seeing this played out in Minneapolis, St. Paul. So if we could just take a breath and try to be thoughtful, nobody's going to come up with the right answer about the southern border crisis tomorrow. But hopefully, as we think about this and talk about this in the weeks and months to come, if we consider context, I think we can get to a perhaps a better solution than if we act hastily.
Well, I think it's like if I can't even make my own bed, I'm not going to walk into somebody else's house and try to rearrange the whole thing. And I think that's when you're talking about the homeless veterans in America, and we've got to kind of clean up our some of our mess that we've made in America before we try to clean up everybody else's. And I think that's, I mean, there's nothing wrong. I actually think it's really cool that a lot of people want to come to America. This is a great country, and people from all over the world still view us as an amazing country and they want to live here. But yeah, I mean, this goes into like then people who are here illegally being able to vote. And it feels like always when with the left trying to, whatever they're trying to push, that there seems to be like some added, positive element that comes out of things for them. So like there's sanctuary cities and all these things. I don't know. It seems a little bit off to me that they just want to open the borders. And so I liked your response there. I think it was good. But I mean, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about on the southern border?
I like what you said. We need to be able to make our own bed before we go in and try to rearrange someone else's entire structure. I guess the thing I would add is that if we don't do things right in our own country, and then we, under false pretense, allow other people to come into our country or bring other people into our country, we set them up to fail. We set them up to a life of misery. We've seen that in the Mideast. We know that a change doesn't always translate into better. Sometimes it translates into death and disease. So I really think we need to be thoughtful and careful. And I think we have to ask our politicians sometimes to quit politicizing every issue.
Yeah.
Some of these issues aren't left, right, middle. Some of these issues are just human issues.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that's huge. And it's the border thing is so complex. It's very... I don't know if you watched the news recently, but they keep talking about the kids in cages. And I mean, I've seen some pictures of kids, and people just in these, like, they look like prison cells and they have like blankets that are like, look like tinfoil. I don't even know. I mean, have you seen anything? Have you seen any of that?
I have.
Yeah. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, on the kids in cages. And I think people are interested, that looks horrible. I don't know. What should we even do about that?
Well, it's obviously not acceptable. But again, I think it results from poorly thought out policy. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have had president after president after president struggle with this issue. Can I snap my fingers and give you the right answer? I can't, Andy. But I think these kids in cages, if they had listened to the political rhetoric of the last 2 months, they might have thought that they were going to come over and have a hotel room. But that's not what they have. These are ill-thought-out politicians pontificating and saying things that aren't even remotely true. But they keep saying them.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think I mean, yeah, the southern border is definitely more, it's more of a, you know, that's a national thing. And so I want to kind of pull back into what's happening here in Minnesota. And so I heard you this morning, you're on a interview, and I'm not exactly sure who was with, but you guys are talking about emergency powers here in Minnesota. And so, I mean, do you want to talk about that for a little bit?
Again, I think context is really important, Andy. People need to step back and say, what are emergency powers?
Yeah.
Emergency powers are something that virtually every state has that literally allows one person, the governor, to take over the governance of the entire state in one fell swoop. We have seen governors across the nation, particularly Governor Newsom and Governor Walz and Governor Cuomo, just unilaterally, in an unprecedented fashion, expand their power, expand the scope of government, lock down Americans, put us under curfews, close the schools, close the businesses, terrorize the seniors, lock down the facilities, lock out the families, lock in the residents, and be glib about compromising Second Amendment rights. This is what we've seen. This isn't just a talking point. This is how tyranny begins. And the whole premise was emergency. And that implies tornadoes and floods. That implies moment by moment, day by day decision making. Yeah. We don't have any of that. We have Governor Walz sitting in his office with his team around him, potentially having negotiations with industry leaders as to what should and should not be included as an essential business. These are not emergency decisions. This is raw backroom politics. And Governor Walz has now taken that last terrible step and told Minnesotans, maybe, just maybe, I would be willing to relinquish some of my emergency powers if you move my way on the budget. $30 billion in 2009 and 10 for our biennial budget. Governor Walz's approach budget proposal, almost $53 billion. In a decade, we're talking about a 70% increase, and he can't get it done through the normal channels, so he's going to use emergency powers and the slow letting go of them as a negotiation tool. Every Minnesotan, I don't care if you're left, right, or middle, should be offended by this raw power grab. It's the most important issue right now in front of us. And I was asked this morning during that interview, would you elevate this issue so highly that you would tell the legislature, do not pass a biennial budget without getting that order of business stripped away and the Never Again bill passed so that Governor Walz couldn't just turn around and reenact another emergency powers a few days later?
Right.
And I said, yes. I think we are at that point. We are seeing such an abuse of our three-branch co-equal government that I would challenge and call on the legislature, do not pass a budget unless Governor Walz relinquishes this. And don't let Governor Walz use the emergency powers to cause you to do something that you don't think is right when it comes to creating a 24-month budget.
So I want to back up a little bit because I and for people who are listening to this, What exactly, like, you kind of defined emergency powers, but what exactly can Governor Walz do with emergency? Like, is there, like, endless power? Or, like, what is this?
Virtually endless power. Let's just look at some of his more than 100 executive orders. One of his orders was to stop pharmacists from filling my prescriptions for hydroxychloroquine. He didn't come at me and say I couldn't prescribe it. Last I know, I don't think he has an MD behind his name. He went to the pharmacy board and said, you tell your pharmacies, don't you dispense the prescriptions for hydroxychloroquine that the doctors are writing. That was one of his orders. He quietly rescinded it 5 months later after who knows how many people's lives were taken that might have been saved. Another one, he sent to more than 500 law enforcement agencies around our state a list of addresses of people who had active COVID-19 disease in their households. This is a violation of their personal health rights. This is a violation of HIPAA. This is a violation of our Constitution. This is why the ACLU came against Governor Walz and said, you can't do that, but he did it. He has gone over and over again on this emergency power bid. And now he's doing it to get his way on the budget.
Why did he specifically go at the pharmacy, like not allowing people to prescribe this or fill this prescription, like if it could save lives? I don't understand why would he even do that? It doesn't even make sense. I mean,
I don't understand why either.
Okay. There's no good answer there. There's no good.
He never stopped us. He never stopped us as physicians from prescribing Flomax for people who are trying to pass a kidney stone. And originally Flomax was used to shrink the prostate and make it so men could pee easier. But we use Flomax in men and women who are trying to pass a kidney stone to try to relax the smooth muscle in the ureter so that hopefully they don't have to have surgery and not have so many narcotics coming their way. He never stopped us there when we prescribed off-label. Hydroxychloroquine has been on the World Health Organization's essential list of medicines for more than a half a century. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that a lot of the countries that have hydroxychloroquine much more easily accessed, they had far better statistics in regards to death rates from COVID-19.
Oh, that's like a whole bunch of, I don't know, I just feel like I got hit by a truck there. That is interesting. So you're saying don't negotiate on a budget until, you know, they end the emergency powers. That's basically what you're saying to the Republicans right now?
The first priority of business has to be end the emergency powers.
Great. Yeah, I mean, do you have anything else you want to talk about in emergency powers? I feel like we just covered a bunch, but...
Well, I think there's lots of people highly motivated on this. I think it's appropriate to give some kudos. I mean, Representative Eric Mortensen has been a powerhouse of a... Say it the way he sees it. And he's the one who wrote the bill on repeal the Emergency Powers Act, also called the Never Again Bill. I think kudos to him and his co-authors, Representatives Munson, Poston, Drazkowski, Miller. And I think kudos to Jake Duesenberg, and because he's been a champion on this. He and I don't agree necessarily on all the strategies. And I think sometimes Jake likes to pound his fist on the table, perhaps more than I do. But we had a great conversation today, I think. And he likes the idea of having politicians sign his pledges. I think that signing pledges is a dangerous thing for any politician to do because oftentimes you're opening Pandora's box. And I think that we do have an obligation as elected officials to be thoughtful and to be ready and willing to consider what's being put before us. If we walk into a room with our minds made up and we've got all the issues figured out and we get elected that way, good luck getting anything done on behalf of Minnesotans.
Well, okay, I just thought of a question. If you were in the same situation as Governor Walz, would you have taken emergency powers? Like, would you have done the same thing for a period of time?
Absolutely, I would have.
Okay.
I would have perhaps that first week or two and said, okay, and then I would have said, I want to create an ad hoc group of Republicans and Democrats from the House and the Senate. I want some people that are skeptical, that maybe don't even like me, and for sure don't feel obligated to say yes, sir, to me. I want that group having some decision-making power in their group and then giving those recommendations to me because I know I'm going to get recommendations from my team. I would have put both of those things in there. I think the idea of responding quickly, especially in the area of personal protective equipment, those kind of things, was very appropriate. I think the lockdown was a marginal decision that quickly could have been, okay, we didn't do this right. This notion of capriciously and arbitrarily deciding what's essential and what's not. I would have reached out and said, okay, Minnesotans, we know already that there's a group of you that are vulnerable. Let's do things like preferred shopping hours for the seniors who have multiple underlying medical problems. Let's keep everybody out of the store for a couple hours so they can come in and they can do their shopping. Wear your mask if you like to. Wear a shield if you like to. Have people deliver things to your home. I would have gotten rid of the fear. I think Governor Walz played too much on fear, and I think his Department of Health did. I think there was always room for hope in there. I think that even early on, we were seeing that. I think the school closures were ill thought out. They should have been meeting 24/7 around the clock trying to put this together. If I were Governor Walz right now, I'd call a group of people together tomorrow, and I'd say, let's figure out a way to Monday relinquish these emergency powers. Let's get moving and try to get something done. We've seen more than half of the legislative session already take place, and not much has gotten done.
So when would you have gotten rid of your emergency powers. I mean, you said you absolutely would have taken advantage of having emergency powers, which is a good thing. I think in times of crisis, you got to figure out what to do quickly. But looking back now, when would you have said, okay, I need to be done with this?
I would have gone to the legislature and say, listen, we have got to have some rapid acting decision capabilities. And emergency powers is one way to get them. But we can create another way. We can create a way that includes the House, the Senate, the Republicans, the Democrats, and myself. That's what they should have done. They should have done that before the session ended. They should have done that in May. They said, we figure this out so that there was no reason for emergency powers to go beyond the regular session. And on May 18th, when we passed the final big bills, emergency powers should have been gone away by then.
Okay. So that makes sense. Wow, that's a lot. I didn't even know that was a thing. And maybe that's just because I'm young and dumb, but don't understand some of this stuff. But emergency powers, I mean, that sounds dangerous. But anyways, you told me before this podcast, you're like, we got to talk about the changing winds. And I was like, I have no idea what that means. So do you want to tell us what the changing winds are?
Well, frankly, I'm a faith-based individual. And for me, changing winds are, let's pivot away from the fear-mongering and let's pivot to hope. I was asked a question last night by a constituent. She said, I have an 8-year-old. She's a dental hygienist. I had an 8-year-old in for a dental cleaning for his teeth. And she asked him to remove his mask so she could do the work she needed to do. And he almost started crying. He was so frightened of what the world would be like if he took his mask off. That is horrific. And that's where we are at today. I would pivot to hope. And to me, the changing winds that we're seeing now is we're seeing a dramatic reduction in hospital beds committed to COVID-19 patients. ICU beds committed to COVID patients is dropped virtually to the bottom of the graph. We have seen deaths drop. We have seen so much good news. And then we look at Sweden, and we're starting to get data for 2020. What was the delta? What was the difference between the expected total number of deaths and the number of deaths that occurred? And in Sweden, it was a 7.7% increase. Again, we have to go back to context. What does that mean? So a 7.7% increase in deaths in Sweden. What was it in their neighbor, Belgium or Spain? 18% increase, 250% higher. Yeah. What did Sweden do? They leaned into its citizens. They said, do the responsible thing. Take care of yourself. If you're vulnerable, do what you can do. Mm-hmm. Did they do harsh lockdowns? No. Did they do school closures? I think only for above 16 for a period of time. We could look at states in our country that didn't take these draconian measures, and they did fine. So I think as we start to see this data, we're starting to get a glimmer of hope that, okay, we didn't need to do this, and hopefully our leaders are understanding that they shouldn't do it again. Another one, in California, the Department of Health released earlier this month that while a little more than 8% of the state's population has ever tested positive for COVID-19, above 8%, almost 40% of the population has antibodies. What does that mean? That means for every case that we detected COVID-19, there's at least 5 times as many people who've had it, recovered, and have antibodies. That's good news. Yeah. We've heard Fauci talk about the need to have 70, 80% of people vaccinated. Not true. Wall Street Journal came out and said, it's an error of omission in science to try to calculate a herd immunity number without considering the people who have already recovered from the natural disease. Herd immunity is what happens when you get a significant portion of the population having protection against the disease so that the disease has no vector in through which to bring the disease to people that are not protected. Typically, the number might be 60 or 70% for some diseases. For measles, probably closer to 90%. But the bottom line is you have to consider both people who have gotten immunity through having the natural disease or gotten immunity through vaccination. Those two numbers together usually define, are we approaching herd immunity? The fact of the matter is we are probably close to herd immunity in many areas of our country. And that's exactly what this article by the Wall Street Journal said earlier this week. And they went on to say this. After a year of millions of COVID-19 cases in the U.S., it's clear that reinfections are rare. Natural immunity is real and shouldn't be ignored. And when Dr. Fauci makes comments, when he's ignoring it, he's fear-mongering. I think the changing winds tell us that, you know what? There's a lot of good news coming, and we're going to be on the right side of this in pretty short order. As far as I'm concerned, we're in the eighth inning.
Yeah. Well, and that leads to a good, a discussion on you're talking about fear, and I'm like, totally. I mean, I live in Madison right now, and I drive back and forth. And when I'm in Madison, I'm downtown at the university just hanging out with my friends. And you got kids who are my age who are walking around outside alone with masks on. Then you got people in their car alone with masks on. And I'm like, what is going on? Why do you have a mask on? You're by yourself. And so I think the level of fear that has been like pushed on the people that just live in the United States, especially young people, is like insane. There's just a crazy amount of fear. And so it seems like a uphill battle that can't be won. But I mean, what do you even say to that? I mean, people my age have completely bought into, like, if you don't wear a mask, you are a bad person. And I guess I'm a bad person because I don't wear a mask all that often. So what do you even do about that? Because there is a lot of fear. There's a lot of people that are just scared and paranoia.
I think it's got to do with stay engaged, educate yourself, get outside your normal boundaries of what you consume for news and information, read to the other side. I think these things are important. I don't think fear does much good for anybody. I really don't. I have very, very few patient encounters where when we're wrapping up our session, I tell the patient, you know what you need? You need to be more fearful. You need to be more anxious. You need to obsess more. You need to get yourself in a place where it's really dark and go sit in a closet for a while. I don't tell many people that. In fact, I had a patient 2 days ago having trouble controlling his alcohol use because of COVID. And it got worse when his girlfriend hung herself. When did that happen? 3 months into the pandemic. Until you've been touched by that fear that's come from the collateral damage, you might be able to focus on just COVID. Right. But COVID has frightened us. But the fact of the matter is, it's literally frightened us away from living.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge, huge point. I mean, right, we talked about in the last podcast how suicide rates have skyrocketed in the last couple of years, and especially within COVID. And yeah, I mean, this is a huge thing. There's a bunch that we could unpack there. But I think, right, you talked about the changing winds, and I want to start something at the end of every podcast that we do, because I think it's important, like I said in the last podcast, we got to stay positive to some capacity. I mean, some you turn on the news and you're like, you know, the world's going to end tomorrow and we're all going to die. And hopefully that doesn't happen tomorrow. But I think that I want to start this thing. I'm just going to call it What's Good, Scott. So basically, you just tell us what's good. What's a good thing that's happened in the last week or the last month or whatever? Like something positive that we can walk away from this podcast not feeling like everything is horrible. So what's good, Scott?
Okay, I'll have two things. The first one is a few weeks ago I said, I know that I need to have a stronger, better conversation with the younger generations. And Facebook seems like it might have perhaps a spectrum of people involved that are in their perhaps last half of life or maybe the last two-thirds of life. But those people that are between 10 and 35, I wasn't really touching. And we talked, you and I talked, Andy, and you said, you got to do TikTok. I said, okay. So yesterday on TikTok, we got our millionth like.
Oh, wow.
And last week we passed 250,000 followers on TikTok. What was really fun about that was last week in the office, we had a woman come in, a new patient, in her 70s. And on the intake sheet that we have people fill out, it says, referred to Catalyst by, and then you fill in the blank. And a lot of times it'll be a family, a friend, a neighbor, maybe a hospital, maybe an emergency room physician. She wrote TikTok. She saw us on TikTok and decided that's going to be my medical clinic.
Great.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think is fun was, I think it's important for our leaders to be able to speak off the cuff, to speak honestly, to be able to improvise, and to be able to react to stressful situations without, if you will, panicking. Now, I get to do that when I'm doing surgery and all of a sudden I've got an artery pulsing blood and it sort of makes everybody in the room nervous. But last Saturday, I have to tell you a story. It's not a particularly flattering story for me, but it is what it is. And I think it's pretty darn funny. So last Saturday, I was on Fox and Friends with Pete Hegseth. And we were going to be on at 6:15. So I set my alarm at 5 o'clock in the morning so that I'd get up. And they'd called the night before and said, let's set up the shot. I think they use Skype. Let's set up the shot about 6 o'clock, they said, or whatever time they said, on the hour. So I said, okay. So I get up at 5 o'clock, and I'm in bed, and I'm reading newspapers. And about 10 after 5, the phone rings. And it's a producer from New York with a little panic in her voice. And she said, Dr. Jensen, are you ready to set up your shot? And I'm lying in bed in my underwear, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, we can do that right now, but I thought we were going to do it on the hour. I thought we'd do it in about 45 minutes. And she said, you're on the air in 2 minutes. My stars. My wife was visiting her mom in Wisconsin. She said, do we have to cancel the program? Can you get ready? I said, oh, no, I can get ready. So I am running into the kitchen to set up and boot up my computer, get the shot set. So while the computer's booting up, I'm on the phone talking to her. I look in the mirror. It's like I put my finger in the socket. My hair got all 15 different directions. So I get my hair all wet. I try to comb it down. It looks pretty marginal, to say the best. Yeah. Haven't brushed my teeth, haven't shaved, and I go running out to the kitchen to get on. I said, shoot, a mile. I'm naked. Yeah. So I run back in, grab a shirt, button that up, boot the video on. Pete Hegseth and I are going to have a conversation. We had been told that we're going to talk about the physical distancing being shrunk from CDC by CDC from 6 feet to 3 feet. So I was ready, in my underwear. Nobody knew it. First question out of Pete Hegseth's mouth was, so what do you think of the emerging crisis on our southern border and the fact that President Biden might be flying some of these people up to Minnesota because in Texas they can't rapidly enough process them? Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that the last 32 seconds. Yeah, right. So anyway, I mentioned just what I said earlier today, that I think that when you have poorly thought out policies, you pay a price. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happening, whether you're talking about the specifics of the southern border crisis or the notion of flying these people to border states. I think there's some 13 border states on the northern border. It's problematic in multiple ways, and that's what I said. And then after that, we went ahead and had a conversation about physical distancing. But I will never forget that morning where getting out of bed to getting in front of millions of people was 8 minutes.
Yeah, and for the people, just so they know that Scott was on Fox and Friends in his underwear. I mean, that happened.
That's not a pretty sight.
No. So that did happen. So, anyways, that's great. I love that story. I think that's really cool. I think we're about 40 minutes into it, and so I mean I don't have anything else to really talk about. I mean, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about or finish up on or give a closing statement or anything like that?
Well, I'd like to just say thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say thank you to the thousands of people that have gone on our webpage and donated. I also want to say thank you to the almost 500 people who volunteered to be a part of our army, working on the ground, boots on the ground for our campaign. Door knocking, signs, phone calling, letters, the whole thing. Almost 500 people signed up for that. Thousands of donors. I would never have dreamt that when 10 days from our launch had passed, that we would have received revenues of over $200,000. Wow. So I just want to say thank you. I think Governor Walz works hard, and I appreciate that. But I think it's time for a change.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing a response by a governor who doesn't respect our individual rights, that is willing to do a unilateral power grab. I think lots of people had hope about one Minnesota, but I think what we're seeing is it's devolved into I'm the one for Minnesota, and that's not the plan. Minnesota needs a different direction. Yeah. The path we're on right now is not sustainable. Preparation, protection, preservation, of all the things that make Minnesota good are at risk. And I would just leave people with one thought. If you want to do some homework this week, just go and look in the Google box, decline of Detroit or decline of Newark. Both of these are cities that enjoyed better days. Both of these are cities that had wealth, opportunity, parks, schools, churches, communities, all the things that you would want in a community. And for more than 50 years, both of those communities, Detroit and Newark, have suffered horrendously from the riots, the lawlessness, and the things that took them down. Don't think for a minute that Minneapolis gets to bounce back next year because we want it to. Minneapolis has been absolutely decimated, and it was decimated by failed leadership, whether you're talking about Mayor Fry or Governor Walz. Our National Guard, they were demeaned. Our police were told to take the pictures off the wall because the third precinct was going down. That was failed leadership. And I'd ask people, please, think about that seriously. These are hard times. It's time for new leadership.
I think the last thing we want to be hearing is in 10 to 20 years is what Minneapolis used to be. And I think you're right. With new leadership, I think the best is yet to come. So I guess that's it for today. And we will be back soon enough. But thank you guys for listening. Make sure to check out, is it drscottjensen.com? Go check that out. There's a bunch of good stuff on there. Make sure to check that out. Make sure to like this. Make sure to subscribe, follow. Give us 5 stars, send us a review. And if you have questions for Scott, send it to drscottjensenpodcast@gmail.com. Ask questions on his Facebook. Go follow him on TikTok if you haven't. Let's try to get 1 million TikTok followers. That would be cool, right?
A million. Where can people find this podcast?
This is on Spotify. This is on Apple Podcasts. It's any podcast outlet that ever. I mean, we have, it's everywhere. So, and it'll be on your Facebook, it'll be on your Instagram, on Scott's Instagram. So just be looking for that. And then I think that's about it. I think I covered everything. So besides that, thank you everybody for listening, and we will see you guys in the next one. Goodbye.